Welcome back to The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our brand new mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and tonight I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Sean Cohen and Dr. Paul Williams. On tonight's episode, we'll discuss ambulatory management of alcohol withdrawal with Dr. Steve Holtz. But before we get started with that, Sean, will you please remind the audience what we do on this show?
Excited to, Carolyn. We are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And a reminder, most of these episodes are available for free CME through VCU Health CE for health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And a very special thanks to our partners, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, for supporting this show. They are a group that is dedicated to promoting academic excellence and leadership in addiction medicine. You can learn more about their organization at acam.org, which is ACAAM.org.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Sure. And why don't I tell us all who we talked to tonight? Tonight, we had the pleasure of talking ambulatory management of alcohol withdrawal syndrome with Dr. Stephen Holt. Dr. Holt is an internist and addiction medicine specialist in Yale's primary care internal medicine residency program. He enjoys teaching about the full breadth of internal medicine topics, though most of his teaching activities revolve around either addiction medicine, the art and science of physical diagnosis, or medical education more broadly. As you will maybe hear on the episode, we'll see if it makes it in, he has an uncanny fascination with medical etymology, and he is notorious at Yale for his uncompromising devotion to bedside rounding. And he adds, this does come up, lastly, at the very pinnacle of nerditude, which is a great phrase, his favorite hobby is painting board game miniatures in excruciating detail. So, as you mentioned, we had a great conversation with Dr. Holt. Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we talked about tonight?
Yeah, happy to. I think the big take-home topics that I got from him were that ambulatory alcohol withdrawal management is safe, cost-effective, effective at treating withdrawal symptoms and helping people stop alcohol, and is often a more patient-centered way to actually help people get through withdrawal. That the first step is really risk stratifying your patients, thinking about absolute contraindications and some relative contraindications that we'll go through, and that the process, although not super complex, does require really close contact during the process.
So with that great intro, let's get to it. Steve, thanks so much for coming on to the show. Let's start with just a couple of questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So can you give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
All right. I am a 46-year-old internist and addiction medicine specialist and associate program director of a residency program. And I have two daughters and I live in Connecticut.
And tell us something a little bit about yourself that you do when you're not doing doctory stuff. Is there some non-medical thing that you do that occupies your time, kids notwithstanding?
Yeah, I would say two primary activities. One would be I love bird watching. It's like become a focal nerd point for me. And like I routinely get ridiculed for taking binoculars with me when I go to medical conferences, or I have binoculars in my car. I have binoculars when I drive my kids to soccer games. It's pretty embarrassing for a lot of people. And then the second one is...
That is exactly what I wanted. Thank you.
Second one is I paint miniatures like for board games and stuff. So that's another fun thing I do.
I'm pretty sure I brought up your bird watching when we went to a conference a week ago.
I think that's true.
Because you were wearing a bird watching t-shirt to a conference.
Yeah, that's quite true. Yeah.
They were like, hello, sir. Are you at the right facility? You look a little bit lost.
Yeah, should be at the ornithologists, association conference or something.
I'm curious now, you know, Steve Holt, this legendary bird watcher, what is the most adventurous thing you've ever done?
I would say the most adventurous thing I've done is backpacking in Iceland was one of my favorite trips of all time. I got to go with three of my best friends from med school, and we were doing the Þórsmörk Trail, which is like basically a 5 or 6 day excursion where you've got all your gear and your food and everything else is on your back and you're just walking through the tundra. It's a popular trail, so you definitely see people along the way, but it is just such an exotic, otherworldly place. I always say that it feels like I'm walking, like every couple hours, you feel like you've set foot onto another set of a different Star Trek episode. It just feels like you're on a different planet constantly. And that's what just makes it such an exciting, awesome trip. I did that trip before I got into birding, for the record. And I wish it had been the reverse, because there were definitely things flying around me that I did not identify at the time.
Any new like books, movies, things that you've kind of sunk your teeth into that have kind of got you hooked?
I would say the book that I've been reading most recently is called Finding the Mother Tree. It's by Suzanne, I'm forgetting her last name right now, but it's a relatively popular and relatively new book, but it just talks about, it's autobiographical, but also relatively scientific, talking about the way that the ecosystem of forests and particularly fungi underneath the surface are all interconnected in this web of collaborative growth rather than competitive, which is sort of the way that the people used to view nature, was that everything's competing, you know, out-competing everything else. But this woman demonstrated through a lot of her research, she's a PhD, that actually there's a great deal of collaboration happening amongst different trees at different times, trees of different species, with these interconnections of sharing resources through fungal networks. It's a pretty fascinating book because it's really like changes the way we think about nature. It's not just this, you know, live or let die kind of thing. It's there's a lot of collaboration happening, and she compares that, uses a lot of metaphor to humans and society and stuff. It's pretty cool.
How many times does the author use the pun fungi in the book?
not as often as she ought to, really. It's just so out there. It's just sitting right there, you know, so she should use it more often. Yeah.
And with that, Sean, I'll actually let you sort of take it away. Why don't you sort of start with our case to help us get started at discussing our topic today, which is managing alcohol withdrawal in the clinic.
Yeah, thanks for passing off, Carolyn. So we're going to start with Mr. X in Cashlack Memorial Hospital. So he is a 45-year-old man. He has a history of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and an alcohol use disorder. And he's coming into primary care clinic today, really feeling like his drinking has started to become a problem and impacting his life. But he's really worried about stopping because the prior times he stopped, he's gone into pretty significant alcohol withdrawal. And so I wanted to start by kind of talking about, how do you actually identify, if a person's coming to you, they say they want to stop drinking, how do you identify people that are at risk for alcohol withdrawal?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways that I think about it. And some are pretty obvious. I mean, things like, you know, how much someone drinks, how long they've been drinking. I think that's sort of the general factors we think about. Or if they've had a history of withdrawals, or they tell you they have withdrawals, then that's kind of a no-brainer. In my experience, while there aren't absolute cutoffs, you know, a person who drinks on a daily basis and has done so for at least a month, that's sort of would be a minimum criteria, as opposed to folks who kind of binge drink on weekends, they're not really that likely to experience alcohol withdrawal. And someone who's only been drinking for 2 or 3 weeks is also not likely to have alcohol withdrawal, regardless of how much they drink. And then in terms of quantity, I would say at least 4 to 6 drinks a day would be someone who would be at risk of developing alcohol withdrawal. So if you're drinking only 3 drinks a day, you're not going to get it. If you've only been drinking for 3 weeks, you're not going to get it. And if you only drink on some days of the week, you're probably not going to get withdrawal either.
That's super helpful. I think having, some set cutoffs that kind of give you a little bit of guide. I find that, and I don't know if you've seen this too, is that for people that have like relatively significant alcohol use disorder and history that like go into withdrawal and then only have a short recurrence, like right after that, even like with a week of drinking, they seem to go back into withdrawal again. Is that something you've seen too? Good. It's not just me.
Yeah. I see so many folks who come to the ER and are there every week. You know, they come in for detox. They're there for like 5 days. They leave the hospital. They relapse for 3 days and then they come back. That person, when they come back, is honestly not at risk for alcohol withdrawal. They just haven't had enough time to sort of, you know, reset the stage for having this, you know, this maladaptive GABA and glutamatergic activity in the brain. So I oftentimes see those folks completely unnecessarily getting, you know, reset with loaded with front loading and getting CWA and being in the hospital for 5 days. Their risk of withdrawal is so low if they've only spent a week outside of the hospital.
sort of echoing on that, this idea of sort of some of our patients who are recently, you know, who have severe alcohol use disorders, who are recently abstinent, they kind of get this like almost like protracted, they're not at risk of like physiologically having seizures, but they feel crummy, you know, they feel crummy, just as you said. So I think sometimes our patients don't have the words to express like how this is really anxiety, how this is really insomnia, and they sort of attribute it to sort of withdrawal. How do you manage those scenarios? How do you try and keep those patients sort of from getting admitted in the hospital?
To be clear, it's still disease. And as you said, Carolyn, it's ultimately it's anxiety. It's social anxiety disorder. It's the need to feel better. Benzos make you feel better. But it's not physiologic alcohol withdrawal. And so we, you know, we just have to be cautious about overdoing it with benzos when the problem is not alcohol withdrawal. It's maybe it's benzo use disorder. Maybe it's, you know, just untreated anxiety. But we shouldn't be, you know, front loading them and using the CEWA and all that jazz.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the pathophysiology of alcohol withdrawal?
Sure. You know, the classic metaphor is the idea that in your brain, your GABAergic system is kind of the brakes in your car, and your glutamatergic system is your gas. And normally the brakes are kind of, you know, in operation most of the time. You know, most of our brain runs on GABA just to cool things down and prevent neurons from firing chaotically. Whereas glutamate is trying to activate things and, you know, process memories and move things forward. When you drink lots of alcohol, you are activating the GABAergic system so much so that you suppress your GABAergic system so that it doesn't function as well. And so then when you take away the alcohol, you're basically firing your gas and your brakes at the same time. And there's just this complete disequilibrium in how your brain is able to basically to maintain you know, the normal cognitive processing. So what happens is your glutamate goes into overdrive, your GABA is not sufficient to stop it, so you are essentially in this hyper-excitatory state, and which is why seizures happen, because every neuron in your brain is just running on overdrive, and the brakes are just not sufficient any further, because you've just kind of dismantled the GABAergic system with prolonged heavy alcohol use. Those are really the main neurotransmitters that that drive alcohol withdrawal states, and those are the ones that we typically focus on when we're treating with benzodiazepines to try and enhance that poorly functioning inhibitory circuitry.
That was a good way to it. I really enjoyed that explanation. I think so. What I'm hearing from you, kind of overall, is that alcohol really overactivates the GABA, which is like cools down the brain, and that when someone's drank a lot of alcohol, they're kind of used to being extra cool. Their body tries to like tamp that down a bit, and then when the alcohol runs out, say they have to go somewhere, they get admitted to the hospital, they run out of money at the end of the month, now all of a sudden they're not getting as much of that cooling as much, so their brain kind of overheats, and that causes seizures and all the symptoms and stuff we're seeing.
This feels like the place to ask this now. So we were sort of talking about some of the symptoms you might expect, and seizures being sort of the complicated withdrawal and sort of the scary things. But can you just talk us through maybe the expected timeline of alcohol withdrawal symptoms? So like what might a patient who has been drinking fairly consistently for the past month, what might they expect to experience on hour one, day two? Sort of what is the progression? What kind of symptoms should we be mindful of for patients who are at risk for withdrawal?
Sure. Yeah, we typically think of early alcohol withdrawals, alcohol hallucinosis, and then severe alcohol withdrawal or complicated alcohol withdrawal. The early alcohol withdrawal symptoms are most commonly seen in the first 24 hours or so after your last drink or after a significant reduction in how much you're drinking. And to be clear, somebody who usually drinks, you know, 2 pints of vodka a day and then just cuts back to, you know, drinking a few nips a day, they still have alcohol in their system, but that dramatic reduction is sufficient to precipitate, you know, mild alcohol withdrawal symptoms. So it doesn't have to be complete abstinence to cause it. But yeah, in those first 24 hours, it's all those kind of classic things we see on the CEWA score. So mild symptoms are, you know, nausea, some, you know, GI upset, anxiety, some tremors, headaches, that sort of sensation of your skin crawling out of your skin. Those would be some of the primary symptoms you would see as early alcohol withdrawal. And then alcohol hallucinosis comes on, you know, day two, day three, and that is, you know, features of psychosis. So basically auditory, visual, tactile hallucinations. And the interesting thing about those symptoms of hallucinosis are that they are not accompanied by the excess sympathetic tone that we see with actual severe alcohol withdrawals. So again, you start off with just mild alcohol withdrawal symptoms for the first day. Then alcohol hallucinosis happens to a subset of people. It's not something you always see, but they're still, you know, calm. They don't have increased, you know, blood pressure, heart rate, fevers, any of those kinds of things. And they're aware that they're hallucinating, I should add, as well. So their ego dystonic. They know that they're, you know, seeing strange things, but they know that they're not real. And then it's around day three, you know, 72 hours to 96 hours after that last drink or after that significant change in use, that people develop more severe symptoms. And this is your seizures. This is your delirium tremens. This is where not only are you having those hallucinations, but you're actually also having agitation and agitated delirium, where you start to get combative. You're seeing things. You think those things are real. And you're, you know, having difficulty processing what's happening around you. I mean, it's really acute delirium. So that's usually the typical timeline. And once you get past 96 hours, if you haven't developed symptoms by then, you're not going to.
And I guess something that I feel like, and this, again, this is, it's like working mostly in the hospital, that I feel like is we often see people who present with the seizures. And I don't know if some of that is just that, I think that's often in people that are coming in more frequently for alcohol withdrawal. But do you see that, like, as people have more episodes withdrawal, their withdrawal generally worsens and some of these symptoms can happen earlier?
Yeah, that's such a great question. It's this idea of kindling. And we know from sort of natural history research that folks who have been admitted for alcohol withdrawal, with subsequent admissions, their presentations seem to get worse and worse and worse. There's, you know, this is where a lot of hand waving comes in, because it's not entirely clear how this happens, but there's some sort of maladaptive changes that are happening to that GABAergic and glutamatergic system that become even more significant, more enduring, and problematic, such that folks are more likely to get DTs, more likely to get seizures. And it's for that reason that we'll come to this when we talk about pharmacotherapy in the outpatient setting, that there are some medications which appear to counteract that kindling phenomenon better than some other medications. So that is an important point to bring up.
I see the same thing, too. I have a healthy amount of respect for and fear, honestly, caring for patients who've had really severe alcohol withdrawal. Just because I find that if you've had really severe alcohol withdrawal in the past with delirium tremens, seizures, requiring ICU management, that those patients you really need to monitor closely, and that they can get sick pretty quickly. And their symptoms often present sooner than what you sort of described as that typical timeline. So,
is there an expiration date on prior complicated withdrawal? By that, I mean, so let's say someone has had a period of abstinence for years and years and years, but had significant or complicated withdrawal symptoms in the remote past and then started drinking again consistently. Like, is that how are we always and forever worried about complicated withdrawal from that point forward? Or is there a chance? Is there a physiologic reset that happens somewhere along the way? Or is it just no way to really tell?
That's a great question. You know, I don't think that we'll be able to find data to answer that question. All I can say is that most of the other kind of late effects of alcohol use disorder, like things like, you know, hypertension, you know, blood pressure lability, things like insomnia, things like, you know, mood states, altered mood states. By the time you get to like 3 months, it seems like for me, I'm just kind of making up this number, it seems like most of the circuitry has righted itself in terms of the brain. Now, there are some things that will never get righted, like, you know, Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome or, you know, alcohol encephalopathy. Or alcohol-related dementia, that's not going to fix itself. And so if that's, you know, if you actually lost brain tissue at this point, there's only so much you can expect to get back. But at least in terms of the stuff that is, you know, mutable, I would say 3 months is a reasonable marker, at least in my mind.
And going back to our patient, Mr. X, he is presenting in your clinic and he's really afraid of going through withdrawal without treatment. And at this time, he really is not sold on the thought of hospitalization or going to detox, because he's quite afraid of getting COVID in the hospital, which was the reality and still is for many of our patients. So I'm curious, I think, first of all, just thinking about a little bit of a higher level view, what are the different treatment location options for somebody who would like assistance with alcohol withdrawal management?
Yeah. So, you know, I think oftentimes when we think about our training in internal medicine or whichever field we're in, we're always so focused on inpatient management of alcohol detox, because that's really where we see so much of it. It's where many of our faculty and mentors have seen it. But the reality is that the vast majority of patients who experience alcohol withdrawal symptoms, or certainly those who are at risk of alcohol withdrawal, can and should be managed in the outpatient, ambulatory, primary care kind of setting. And we'll talk about that in more detail in a moment. So those are the two sort of ends of the spectrum. But then in the middle, there are things like these, you know, short-term hospital programs, or, you know, programs that basically exclusively do detox, that are oftentimes affiliated with an intensive outpatient program or other kind of substance use disorder treatment centers. You know, so you've got ambulatory, partial hospitals, and then folks can certainly come to the emergency room and get triaged from there to the outpatient setting, or they can get admitted. And then on the inside, you've got general floors, you've got step downs, you've got ICUs. But that's kind of the full spectrum, I would say.
I will say the fact that you're saying that like most alcohol withdrawal can and should be managed in the outpatient setting was such like an eye-opening thing to me as an addiction medicine fellow. I mean, I don't know about you, Carolyn and Paul, but like in my training, it was like alcohol withdrawals in the hospital, and that's the only place we manage it.
Yeah, I think that's right. But just because, you know, even as a medical student, you're told really the only withdrawals that can kill you are benzodiazepines and alcohol use. So that is, of course, the thing that locks right into your brain, that if you're not careful, you're going to kill this patient. And so that the idea of managing that in the outpatient setting is a little bit terrifying. It remains terrifying to me, BT Dubs. So I guess I'm wondering, you see the majority of patients, I guess, can you talk to me or sort of describe the characteristics of a patient who is best served in the outpatient setting as opposed to who actually needs to be admitted? Can you help us triage this thing so I don't accidentally kill a patient?
That's a reasonable request. Yeah, I would say the data is that I like to think of it in two steps. So the first one is to look for absolute contraindications to ambulatory therapy. And then if there are none of those, then I look at the kind of relative contraindications, the things where if there's enough of them that add up, I'm gonna say this person should be inpatient. But if they don't have a bunch of those, then it's reasonable to do it. So the absolute contraindications are basically history of complicated withdrawals. You know, no surprise there. If you've had DTs and alcohol withdrawal seizures, you know, do not pass go. Do not collect $100. Go straight to the inpatient unit. If you are actively in moderate to severe withdrawals in my office, I probably would just as soon send you by ambulance to the emergency room rather than mucking about with trying to walk you down to the pharmacy to get your, you know, get your diazepam to get started. So it's already basically too late. You know, the horse has left the barn. So that's a person I'm going to send to the hospital. Those are really my absolute contraindications. And then my relative contraindications are, it's basically comorbidities, which we'll talk about, pregnancy, which is, I'm not going to call it a comorbidity, but I'll call it a complication. And then, and thirdly, psychosocial sort of complexity. Those are the three sort of groups of relative contraindications. And I can go into them. Now, in terms of comorbidities, it's kind of the things you'd expect. So advanced heart failure, you know, like class two, three heart failure, legitimate cirrhosis. I don't mean like, you know, steatohepatitis, because everyone with alcohol, you know, use disorder is going to have some degree of steatohepatitis, but actually legit full-blown cirrhosis. Probably going to want them to be inpatient because it just gets more complicated with, you know, dosing their benzos, etc. Same thing with kidney disease. If you've got stage 3-4 kidney disease, it gets a little complex there. Folks who've had a significant head injury, folks who've had, you know, significant unstable mental illness, you know. So if you've got somebody who's having bipolar disorder with psychotic features, that's not going to work in the outpatient setting, or schizophrenia. And also advanced COPD, like if you're on oxygen, that also just makes, you know, dosing your benzos just a little bit riskier, because it's, you know, that risk of overdosing them a little bit gets a little bit too, it's too easy to overdo it with the benzos. So that's your comorbidities. And then in terms of pregnancy, that's pretty straightforward. It's just too risky if you're basically juggling two different lives rather than one, if you're trying to manage alcohol withdrawal in a woman who's pregnant. The stakes are just, you know, a lot higher. And then the third one is psychosocial complexity. So beyond whether they have, you know, like I said, bipolar disorder with psychotic features, if they are homeless, if they have, or if they simply live alone, if they have significant issues with getting to and from clinic, you know, they have no means of transportation, or, you know, they don't have access to a phone, you know, those kinds of things, it's just going to be so hard to ensure that you're connecting with them on a daily or nearly daily basis. that just logistically you just can't really manage their alcohol withdrawal in the outpatient setting, even if you otherwise would have liked to. And then sort of tied to that is just if they have a bunch of other substance use disorders that are active, probably would be better served sending them to the inpatient setting as well. You know, if they're actively using, you know, a bundle or two of heroin a day, probably best that they're in the hospital.
If somebody is stable on buprenorphine naloxone, for example, for their opioid use disorder, would that be a contraindication to doing an ambulatory detoxification?
I don't think so. Practice? Yeah, I think it'd be perfectly fine for someone who's stably on Suboxone. Methadone, I guess that would be kind of one of the lower tier relative contraindications. You know, if somebody's on 100 of methadone and you're talking about giving them, you know, up to 80 milligrams of Valium a day on day one, you know, it makes any of us get a little bit of angina to do that. So I might be a little bit less likely to do that. And certainly someone with a history of benzo use disorder, you know, I'd rather have them be inpatient as well. Not just because benzo use disorder is complicated enough, but also you're going to be potentially treating them with benzos, so it just gets a little dicey.
And I guess my other question, just to kind of flip things a little bit, are what would be the clinic requirements? I know we'll get into the actual, what this management will look like, but is there anything that the clinician actually needs on their side to be able to successfully do this, like capacity for follow-up or having a social worker on staff or what have you? Is there anything that sort of facilitates the process from the, I almost said provider side. It almost got Twitter mad at me. So we'll say clinician side of things.
Great. Yeah, I think ideally I wouldn't like to start this on a Friday because then you've got 2 days that are just a little bit trickier to check in with them. I mean, you can certainly, you know, make an appointment with yourself on the weekend to reach out, but it's just a little bit more tedious to deal with something if there is a problem on the weekend. But otherwise, I'll start it pretty much any day of the week. And as long as I can make the call the next day, either myself or, you know, one of our nurse practitioners or a nurse could do it, I'd probably say that I think it would be tricky for a nurse to know how to, you know, make the adjustments to the dosing. So I'd have no reservations about a nurse practitioner, a PA, you know, an MD or whatever to do it. But I think it does have to be somebody who's savvy to the, you know, the pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics of the different benzodiazepines and be able to triage the patient effectively. So, but otherwise, I don't think there's any special resources that you really need. And you don't, as we'll, you know, well, we could say now, I don't think you need to see these people in the office. You ideally would want to at least have a televideo visit with them every other day and touch base with them by phone at a minimum every day.
If someone didn't have, like, I mean, just thinking about, I mean, hopefully COVID doesn't get worse again and we can keep having in-person clinic appointments. But if someone didn't have, like, Zoom or something like that, would just being able to do it on the telephone, like, make them not a candidate in your eyes? Or could you do it mostly through telephone?
You know, I guess in a way it comes to the fundamental issue here, which is that there are some patients who you've decided based on the relative contraindications that they should probably be inpatient, and that would be your preference. But as Carolyn alluded to before, sometimes patients are like, nope, not going to do it, not going inpatient. You can't make me go inpatient, so I'm just going to, you know, continue to drink 2 pints of vodka a day. And I, you know, as you know, we're addiction medicine people. Harm reduction is like in our blood. And so, you know, if it comes down to it and you'd like the person to go inpatient, but they're not going to do it, I'm going to treat them. I'm going to do a taper. I'm going to do the alcohol, you know, management or ambulatory management for them. What I'll do is I'll document that I had a conversation that, you know, recommended that they go inpatient. But once I've documented that, then whether they don't have a video camera on their phone or they are using heroin or they, you know, do have some degree of mild cirrhosis, I'll probably still do the outpatient detox because it's better than the alternative, which is just that they just, you know, drink themselves into oblivion. So that's kind of the bottom line, I guess, is that, you know, you do what you have to do in the end.
Yeah, I think it's, so what I'm hearing from you is like the absolute contraindications as titled are absolute of like someone having DTs before, obviously about to go into DTs in your office, but kind of the relative stuff of having some sort of severe comorbidities that make you nervous that alcohol withdrawal could tip them into the over the edge are relative, and for you, patient-centeredness, and if a patient is like, there's no way I'm going into the hospital, kind of trumps that in some aspects, and your overall goal is to hopefully help them stop drinking.
Yeah, you totally said it. There's still those absolute contraindications that I'm really not going to budge on. If you've had DTs, you're going in an ambulance, or I'm just going to let you continue to drink, because it's too risky for me to say, hey, go home and quit drinking with the pills I'm going to give you, and let's just hope you don't have a seizure and aspiration pneumonia and die. That's just too high risk. But for those relative contraindications, yeah, we sort of play the harm reduction angle.
And it made me think of the four C's. That's what you listed in terms of relative: CHF, cirrhosis, CKD, COPD.
Yeah, right.
So
on.
A nice way to think about what are some of the comorbidities you want to screen for in terms of medical comorbidities and unstable psychiatric conditions.
So. I always love groups of letters that helps us to remember things.
Especially when they're the same letters.
Yeah, so easy.
And then if we want to put
it's
it
the
in.
Rocket medicine right there.
Three C's to diagnose a substance use disorder, control craving and consequences, and now the four Boom. C's. So.
A little bit of etymology. You guys know what acronym means? Acral is like, acral means fingertip, right? Like we talk about the acral parts of your body. So an acronym, and name means, or nim means name. So it's the tip of a word, which is the first letter. It's the fingertip of a word. So that's what an acronym is. It's a collection of fingertips.
I get to learn about alcohol withdrawal and etymology today. So two for one.
I love etymology.
So, Steve, you alluded to the fact that we can treat this, you know, in the outpatient setting. What medication regimens do you use for ambulatory alcohol withdrawal?
Yeah, we preferentially use either benzodiazepines or gabapentin. In the benzodiazepine class, we're focusing on the long-acting benzodiazepines. And, you know, there's a lot of hesitation initially to use long-acting benzos, even in the inpatient setting. But now that there's just been more and more data that, you know, even folks who have liver disease, it just seems like the gentle ride that long-acting benzos provide just makes them an ideal choice, even in folks with cirrhosis, actually. So we use, my preference is diazepam or clodiazepam oxide, also known as Librium. And the doses are typically, I like to think of there being sort of two ways that I decide on which dose I'm going to use on day one. So it's typically a 4-day taper, because these long-acting benzos, even if you only give them 4 days of treatment, you're really giving them like a 7 to 10 day supply, because they last so long with all the metabolites. But I somewhat arbitrarily look at how much they're actually drinking. If somebody tells me they're drinking more than 10 drinks in a day, more than 10 standard drinks in a day, I tend to go on the higher dose sort of regimen. So let's just focus on diazepam. On day one, I'm going to give them 20 milligrams four times that day. So 20 milligrams Q6 on day one. If they drink less than 10 drinks in a day, then I'm okay erring on a lower side. So I'll just do 10 milligrams Q6 on day one. That's the only difference is on day one between somebody who drinks more than or less than 10 drinks. On days 2, 3, and 4, it's the identical regimen. And it's basically just 10 milligrams three times a day, 10 milligrams two times a day, and then 10 milligrams once on the last day.
For folks who prefer to use chlorodiazepam oxide, their regimen would look like using 100 milligrams every 6 hours on day one, followed by 50 milligrams TID, then BID, and just once a day for individuals who drink more than 10 standard drinks a day. And now if you're working with an individual who drinks less than 10 standard drinks a day, the dosing regimen would actually start at 50 milligrams four times a day, followed by three times a day, BID, and once a day.
In addition, I'd give them typically 5 PRN doses, and they're allowed to take up to 1 PRN dose per day. So if somebody got those 50 milligram chlorodiazepam oxide tablets, they're getting 10 doses that are prescribed, because it's 4, 3, 2, and 1. So that's a total of 10 pills. But then they're getting 5 extra pills that they can take, you know, if their symptoms are persisting, if they're having, you know, anxiety, tremulousness, feeling like they're crawling out of their skin, then by all means, they have that extra dose to take basically on each day. And same goes for diazepam. I'd give 5 extra 10 milligram tablets. And then gabapentin is the other medication that we use. And I use it similarly with, greater than 10 drinks or less than 10 drinks. My greater than 10 drinks dose is 600 milligrams. So it'll be 600 milligrams four times a day on day one. And then the less than 10 drinks per day dose is 300 milligrams. So 300 milligrams, four times on day one, three times day two, you get the gist. And for those folks as well, I give an extra five tablets of 300 milligrams of gabapentin. But the regimens are otherwise pretty identical. It's just you're, you know, substituting a different medication in a different dose, but it's the same kind of approach.
And Steve, can I ask, especially for someone who's drinking, say, more than 10 drinks a day, are there any circumstances where you would have them try to taper off their alcohol use? I guess, you know, how are you counseling around the alcohol use? Are you just saying, okay, stop, and then we're going to start these medications? Or do you counsel patients to try and cut down a week in advance of withdrawal management? Like, what does that counseling around their actual alcohol use look like?
I tend to just have them plan on starting in the morning on a particular day. So when you wake up, take your first dose of whatever it is, diazepam, clonazepam oxide, or gabapentin. You know, oftentimes you're, of course, meeting these people the day before, either in the morning or the afternoon. And a lot of them, they'll show up at the office, they've already had a few drinks that day. And I just say, you know, today's a wash. You know, do whatever you normally do today. And then tomorrow we're going to start fresh. You know, you're done with alcohol by midnight tonight, or whatever, you know, whatever time you would quit drinking. And then tomorrow you start your first dose. I don't typically tell them to try and cut back beforehand. More often than not, you know, by the time we're getting to the stage where we're talking about doing an alcohol detox, it means that they've tried to cut back in some form or other in the past and haven't been successful at it. So I tend to just say, you know, if you're ready to do this, you know, tomorrow or Wednesday or whatever it is, that's our go date.
You mentioned some PRN doses. Is it, and earlier you had talked in about kind of check-ins that you do when you're doing this management. Can you tell us a little bit about the check-ins and how you instruct people to take the PRNs and that kind of thing?
Yeah, we typically will check in with them each day, at least by phone. It's great if they can come in person if they could come in person every day, that'd be great. But I think that's a little, you know, that's a lot to ask of most patients. But at the least, you should be able to touch base on them every day. I like to take a look at them with my eyes through a phone camera or whatever, at least, you know, every other day if I can. And you're asking them, you know, the basic symptoms, you know, that you'd see with a CY. You're, by being able to talk to them and see them on the phone or at least talk to them, you're getting a sense of how, like, slurred their words are. Are they over-sedated? Are they confused? It's nice to be able to talk to whoever lives with them as well to get their perspective. You know, is the significant other or the son or the, you know, mother, whatever, you know, saying this patient's not making sense. They've been sleeping all day, those kinds of things. So I really think it's important to try to get collateral if you can. And, you know, again, you know, if this was a more formal setup, like with a partial hospital program, you'd probably be doing a CWA every day. But it's just kind of a tall order to go through the whole CWA on the phone with folks. And I honestly feel like you're getting a pretty good picture just by talking to them and getting a gestalt for how things are going. I've never really felt I needed a score to guide me, though, you know, some folks may differ and want to be a little bit more quantitative, I guess, in their assessments.
I will say in my own practice, I have used the SAW score, the short alcohol withdrawal scale score, just for if you've never done this before, it's kind of a nice framework just to make sure you're asking the certain questions, because I can get pretty nervous managing this outpatient. And at least it gives me a sense of, like, are things getting worse? Are things getting better? Especially because while I would love to see my patients via phone on telehealth, they will promise me they can do it and that it will be feasible. It just, I can't get the camera to work. I can't get X, Y, and Z. And it just gives me a little bit more security if I can't see them via phone, even if to the best of my ability, I thought that plan was in place.
Yeah, I've heard of the SAWS. I haven't actually used it myself, so I'll take a closer look at it.
Any other medications we should know about? I feel like I've heard some wild enthusiasm for phenobarbital. Like, I feel like that's back on the upswing, which is certainly not something I'd be cheerfully managing in the outpatient setting, but or any other comfort medications that we should have in our back pocket in case patients aren't doing as well as we might like.
There's a lot of different medications that have been studied for this, and I'll just mention phenobarb first. You know, at ASAM, you know, the American Society of Addiction Medicine conference recently, I saw some, you know, a lot of talk, a lot of hubbub about phenobarbital, but particularly in like an emergency room setting where you're deciding that a patient who's coming in for alcohol withdrawal may actually be perfectly fine going home. And if you can hit them with phenobarbital in the ER, you know, give them a loading dose and then maybe a follow-up dose, then you probably could send them home. They don't have, again, any of those high-risk absolute contraindications. I'm not going to be given phenobarbital in my office. That's just a place I'm not going to go. So it's mostly, I think, for ER kind of triage situations. Other medications that have been used, and carbamazepine, I think, is a perfectly reasonable substitute for gabapentin. I just think most internists are just much more comfortable using gabapentin, so that would be my preference. Other medicines that I've been studied but I think have less data and less support are things like baclofen, valproate. There's a bunch of others that I'm drawing a blank on right now, but there have been a lot of meds studied, but really the best ones are the ones that I've mentioned. Those are the ones that have the most significant data, and even like head-to-head trials, you know, some good like RCTs, that kind of stuff. It's really the long-acting benzos and gabapentin, and again, carbamazepine is reasonable too.
And going back to the two favorites, is there a reason you would choose gabapentin over a benzodiazepine for one patient versus another? What can you talk us through the arithmetic that goes into that decision making?
Yeah, for me, I will use gabapentin in a person who doesn't have too many relative contraindications. So I'm feeling a little bit more comfortable about them, as opposed to like the harm reductionist, I'm doing this because the person refuses to go to the hospital kind of thing. And then if the person has mild alcohol withdrawal symptoms, you know, mild CWA kind of scores on right at that first visit where they're already a little jittery, I'll probably use a benzo in that person. Even though gabapentin has been shown to be perfectly safe in terms of, you know, there's no increased risk of seizures in the outpatient setting, I just think that all of us feel a little bit more comfortable and somebody who's always withdrawing, just going straight to giving them a benzodiazepine. So that's probably my, the fork in the road for me is if they have actual symptoms or if they have a decent number of relative contraindications that I would have liked them to be inpatient anyway.
I think one nice pro of gabapentin is that there's more and more data coming out that it is an effective med for alcohol use disorder too, which, spoiler alert, we have an upcoming episode going over meds for alcohol use disorder. But if it's in the select kind of patients that I think Steve talked about, you're able to continue the gabapentin, then hopefully has an effective med.
That's absolutely right. And we sort of alluded to this before, but one of the things that's been shown with gabapentin compared with, you know, head-to-head trials with like lorazepam, for example, is that gabapentin seems to reduce the risk of that kindling phenomenon we were talking about. There's something about how gabapentin works in the brain that it decreases the risk that people will have, worsening DTs down the road. And of course, in addition, gabapentin is less sedating. It's, less, foggy thinking than benzodiazepines. And that's why it's really, all else being equal, it would probably be my first line choice in folks who are, lower risk and don't have any active withdrawal symptoms at the time.
And you alluded to the fact that there is evidence through different studies. Is there any evidence specifically for the safety of ambulatory alcohol withdrawal management?
Yeah. So as I said, the majority of patients, can and should be treated in the outpatient setting. And there have been, there's been some significant research looking at this. Some of it was sort of naturalistic studies where they just looked at, 1,000 patients who had been treated in the outpatient setting and found that the rate of seizures was around 1% in folks who didn't even get medication at all. This was a much older study. It was like from the early 80s or late 70s, where they just looked at 1,000 people, didn't give them any medication, just gave them counseling for alcohol withdrawal. And again, 1% developed a seizure. So that's with no meds. And so then looking at studies where they actually give them meds, whether it's gabapentin or benzos or what have you, there's never a difference for the rate of seizures, because the number of folks who actually develop seizures is so minuscule, it's negligible, which sort of demonstrates that it's perfectly safe in the outpatient setting. If you look at completion rates, that one study that I had seen showed that certainly if somebody gets admitted for detox, their likelihood of completing that detox is pretty darn high, right? I mean, you've got a captive audience, so your rates of completion are in like the 90s. For outpatient detox, the rates of completion are around 70-75%. And that doesn't mean that, 25% of people ended up having seizures and DTs. It just means that 25% of people ended up relapsing to alcohol because, again, they're still at home. There's alcohol all around them. So the completion rates aren't quite as good as inpatient. But the benefits are much shorter treatment duration and dramatically lower costs, right? I mean, you're talking a fraction of the cost of a person being at home, just getting a prescription and getting a couple phone calls from their doctor compared with, 5-6 days of being hospitalized. So it's for that reason that there's just a strong recommendation to really, you know, focus on outpatient if the patient screens in such a way that they'd be safe in that environment.
And I think you brought up a lot too of kind of doing, being as patient-centered as possible, and kind of, I know that a lot of the patients that we care for with substance use disorders, when they're in the hospital, they feel like healthcare is often a very stigmatizing place for them and it's hard to engage. And so I think avoiding the hospital for a lot of people with alcohol use disorder and substance use disorders is a big goal. And so I think this can also earn a lot of trust with them, showing that you can kind of help them do these things at home.
Absolutely. And, you know, so many folks have drink because of social anxiety disorder, for example, or panic disorder. They just can't do it in the hospital. You know, they get there, they go there fully wanting to detox, and then they're in the emergency room for like, you know, 90 minutes and they're done. They just bolt because they just can't handle that kind of stressful environment. So it's no surprise. This is a much more patient-centered approach. I agree.
And I think one last question I might have in terms of sort of other stuff, like the medications are exciting and obviously the focus here, but you know, in some of my reading, I've seen like counseling patients to stay hydrated when appropriate and avoid caffeine when they're sort of in the withdrawal period, which for me, I think would probably make things much, much worse. Or even sort of, you know, prescribing thiamine or folate. Is there any other sort of other stuff that we should be doing as we're sort of managing symptoms and just making sure that they're actually being safe? What other supportive things can we offer our patients?
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the caffeine thing. That does sound like a dark recommendation to give to folks. But I have definitely heard of, you know, staying hydrated is important. Yes, thiamine and folate, you probably should just go ahead and prescribe those two things as well for folks you're prescribing your ambulatory detox medications to. It's nice to have a recent set of liver function tests, you know, so if you're seeing them in the office and you're planning on doing a detox, you know, sending them to the lab just to get their, you know, their kidney function and their LFTs done is just a nice extra thing to have before you start this to make sure there's no surprises. And again, it's nice to have an ally. That's all. I mean, you know, somebody checking in on them, I just think makes it a more successful process. That's all I can think of, though. I don't know if my colleagues have other thoughts.
A lot of thoughtful head shaking happening here.
I mean, I think we both learned this from Steve, so I think all of his knowledge is the knowledge we have. So,
and because of this and the knowledge that Steve has imparted on us today, Mr. X, he was successful. You were able to manage his ambulatory alcohol withdrawal. Later on, we're going to have an entire episode dedicated to pharmacotherapy for alcohol use disorder. So we're not going to focus on that here today, but I encourage you to take a listen to that as well. So I think to wrap things up, Steve, what are your main take-home points for our listeners today?
I think I would emphasize that ambulatory detox is safe, it's effective, it's cost-effective, and it's more patient-centered. It's not complicated. That's my first take-home point. Second one is you do have to risk stratify patients and decide if they have any of those absolute contraindications or if they have too many relative contraindications, then you should really focus on getting them inpatient. And thirdly, if you do decide to initiate an ambulatory detox, it is important to keep close tabs on them as best you can, whether it's seeing them in the office, seeing them on the phone, or actually at least reaching out to them by phone and touching base with somebody who's supporting their detox.
So this has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge about addiction medicine. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. Special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcu.health.org. All you have to do is to create an account. Until next time, I've been Carolyn Chan.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams.
And I'm Sean. Thanks for joining us today and letting us bring you some pearls on substance use disorders.